Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome now to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner with you. And today, an historic reenactment of sorts set on the colonial frontier of Australia. In 1876, explorer William Oswald Hodgkinson led the last government-funded expedition into the Simpson Desert, ostensibly to find land suitable for pastoral expansion. But Hodgkinson's diary from this journey reveals that his main interest in the desert country was to find the source of the valuable native narcotic known by the local Aboriginals as pitchery. In this feature, a group of latter-day expeditioners follow in Hodgkinson's footsteps, using the surveyor's diary as their guide to try themselves to track down the story of the elusive pitchery. Their journey, like that of Hodgkinson, reveals a wider history of colonisation and environmental change in the Simpson Desert country. So let's join biologist Mike Lepnick, archaeologist Hugh Barton, and historian and writer Tom Murray as they go in search of the Pitchery Trail.
June 7th, 1876. The natives here bring large shells from the northwest and tell mysterious legends of a place called Peacheringa, where the local tribes carry on extensive commerce in a narcotic they call pitchery.
Well, here we are at Coonjee Lakes, and we're not alone.
No, we're not alone at all. There's a huge number of black swans in the water.
There's something very visually confronting about such a large water body in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, I really find it so after having driven through hundreds of kilometres of alternating sand plain, sand dune, gibber, which in the harsh sunlight looks quite a forbidding landscape, and driving along from Innamincka over a few dunes, and then suddenly, wow, there's this huge flat body of beautiful cool water right in front of your very eyes. It's in the middle of the arid zone. It's quite amazing.
The other thing that strikes me here is there's obviously a very large number of rabbits. It's late afternoon at the moment. The sun's not quite down yet, and already we've seen about 10 rabbits jumping across the track, and there's an incredibly large number of rabbit holes in the sides of the dunes and rabbit shit just everywhere. It's pretty hard, I suppose, to imagine what this landscape was like before there were rabbits, and always in the back of my mind wondering whether there were as many of the native marsupials, such as hare wallabies and bettongs here, then as there are rabbits now.
Looking at the large number of birds, you'd think that this place could, and the water, this place could have supported quite a large human population.
Yeah, certainly in the recent historic part in past, in the ethnographic record, there are records of very large numbers of people living around the Coonjee Lakes, and it's not hard to see why. With such a large, pretty much permanent body of water, supporting a diverse range of plants and animals for people to forage.
To the natives, this herb is known by the names of pitchery and pitcheringa, and neither coaxing nor presence would induce them to disclose the precise position of this herb. In common with other savages under similar circumstances, these natives have legends which protect the pitchery and pitcheringa from curious inquirers.
The other thing is what are we doing here at Coonjee Lakes? We've come here because this is the place where William Hodgkinson started to follow the Pitchery Trail in his explorations of the pastoral country of Western Queensland. Hodgkinson came down here looking for supplies. There was an established station at Coonjee, as the Aboriginals called it, and he came down here to get supplies and then go back up into Queensland and explore the pastoral country in Western Queensland. While he was down here, he made note in his journal that the Aborigines here received shells and a narcotic called pitchery from the northwest. And he spent a large amount of time on his journey looking for that pitchery.
This wasn't the first time that he was made aware of pitchery, though. I mean, he'd heard of it before?
Yes, and it wasn't the first time he'd been to Koondje either. Hodgkinson had been out here, well, in this part of the world on two previous occasions, first as a member of the Burke and Wills expedition, and the second time as second-in-command of McKinley's relief expedition to go and find Burke and Wills. And he came to Koondje on that occasion. And on both of those trips, and on the Northwest expedition, the one that we're going to follow now, he states that he chewed pitchery habitually whenever he couldn't get tobacco.
Why do you think pitchery is such a mysterious plant?
I think probably it's mysterious because of its drug properties and the stories that went along with the different kinds of effects that it had on people. It's been described variously as just having a stimulating effect to having a completely knockout, stupefying effect, like a hallucinogenic, and people described as just lying around completely stupefied by the drug. Certainly it's got some pretty powerful properties, and its other role was used as emu poison, mixing it with water and leaving it, say, either in a small waterhole or a coolerman. Some of the explorers were pretty wary of drinking from some of the waterholes in the area because they were concerned that Aboriginal people had used pitchery in the waterhole for just that purpose. And it would certainly be enough to, I don't know whether it would knock out a horse or a camel, but it may have. It was certainly enough to make them very uncomfortable, I'd imagine.
A pretty useful commodity then. Is there stories or songs associated with it?
I'm sure there must be, for such an important plant as pitchery was within the Aboriginal economy, at least in the northeast corner of the Simpson Desert, where large quantities of the drug were harvested, processed and traded out.
Pitchery grows in the dune fields throughout Australia, the Wasia hopwoodii, the plant that you produce pitchery from, but the actual plant where the pitchery was produced only grows in one small part of the northeast Simpson Desert. It took Hodgkinson 5 weeks to find pitchery after leaving Koondje Lakes, but I suppose it took such a long time because they were travelling with horses, and it's important that you spell your horses and find water and do the surveying and mapping that his party was doing as well, given that we've got a four-wheel drive and not so many constraints on water. I hope it won't take us that long.
The Northwest Expedition. July 11th, Koondje Station. Left Koondje with much regret. The natives of this locality display a demeanour to us which is invariably pacific and cheerful. But the process of European occupations must tend to the usual result and consign them to the fate of Aboriginal tribes in general.
Day 2, 150 kilometres north-northwest of Koondje Lakes.
Walking across the hard, stony gibber. If you were in the middle of a gibber plain here, we're well off Hodgkinson's track and presumably the track of most people moving through this landscape. Is there any archaeology out here?
Yeah, it's surprising that even in a place that looks as desolate as this, just looking around on the ground, you can see the odd signs of Aboriginal people that have preceded us and preceded all Europeans to this country. The odd flake, swallowed a fly. The odd piece of gibber that's been split and tested to see whether it's good raw material. Probably as people have been moving in between places. As they go along, opportunistically, looking at the ground, picking up good quality raw material and having a bash to see if it's any good.
So basically people have been everywhere?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, there's some people that say, depending on your definition, you could pretty much classify the whole of the Australian landscape as a site, in the sense that there's abundant evidence of human occupation all the way across this whole country.
What about the concept of wilderness?
Yeah, the concept of wilderness is something that I know some of my Aboriginal colleagues find fairly offensive, in that it's a concept that seems to preclude the presence of humans in a landscape. You know, when most people talk about sort of pristine natural wilderness, they're thinking about forests and open untouched areas where there's been no evidence or signs of human habitation, whereas in fact in Australia that's really just not the case, that all of these landscapes have been inhabited by people before we came here, and to some degree they've all had an impact on that environment, and in many subtle ways and perhaps some more obvious ways, that environment has been changed and altered as a result of humans interacting with that landscape. So I think it's pretty important that when we talk about you know, wilderness, that it must include that element of humanness, if you like, that people were here and they've interacted with this place and they're part of it.
July 27th. The natives brought a sample of pitchery just taken out of a trench in the sand, where it undergoes a process of sweating before use. Our three new native friends accompanied us to the next tribe, whom they presented as the occupants of the pitchery country. Had a lot of trouble with our guides as they kept heading off in different directions. Being anxious, I fancy, from repeated signal fires, to avoid something which lay in a northwest direction from our camp. July 28th. Today, after seeing a thick native signal fire rising northwestwards, I started our own native tracker, Larry, in the direction towards the fire, with the rest of the party following on behind. As we proceeded, the natives ahead kept lighting fresh fires, and after realizing that they were simply trying to mislead us, I refused to take any notice of their smoke and struck out north, towards the direction of some sandhills.
Well, we've just woken up on a barren gibber plain just outside of Birdsville. We've woken up with a 360-degree view of absolutely nothing but, well, shiny black rocks when you look into the sun and red rocks when you look the other way.
How hopeful do you think Hodgkinson was of finding pitchery when he left the area of today's Birdsville?
Well, after he left Coongi, he was asking for directions the whole way from the Aboriginal people. And they kept saying, it's that away, pointing to the northwest. And well, Hodgkinson just kind of kept going, following these directions. So he went from Coongi Lakes up through Goyder's Lagoon up into the Diamantina, and then headed out from the Diamantina over to the Mulligan. And I think, I mean, he knew he was getting in the right direction, but the closer he got, the harder it was to find. Everyone kept saying it was this way, but then it was that way, and after a while he worked out that he was being sent around in circles because no one wanted him to find the precious foliage and this very valuable trading commodity. No one wanted Hodgkinson to go along there and find it, and that might have been out of fear that the white people who seemed to have taken so much, taken land and water holes, might take the precious foliage as well.
All right, let's get out of here.
July 30th. The natives affirm that the pitchery lies north of west.
Day 3. Left the empty gibber for civilization. Birdsville. Population 100. We're hoping to meet Linda Crombie, a Wankanaru woman, who might have some knowledge of pitchery.
right?
Yeah. So,
Yeah, all the pitcheries.
Do you remember anything about the pitchery, yeah?
Yeah. They're all died out now. Nothing left.
Did the pitchery grow around here?
No, not here. Baduri.
Did people down here chew pitchery?
Oh, yeah, old Willie here. Willie Harris chew pitchery. I don't. Make you drunk.
Had you ever tried it?
No, I could see a lot of people in chewing tobacco, you know?
Yeah.
And pitchery. I don't like it. Just the smell of it. I went out in the desert there with my old grandmother and grandfather. Went right out the side of Baduri there. We got some pitchery.
Yeah, we heard some people talking about it, that it helped stimulate them to walk long distances in the desert.
Yeah, that's right. But you don't get it out here, you go out.
Did people used to carry the pitchery around the country? So did people used to bring pitchery from Baduri down to here, down to Birdsville?
Yeah, and my sister chewed pitchery. You go to Alice Springs, a lot of people choose, but they got their pitchery different.
Oh, yes. How is it different?
Well, it grows like a big bush.
Yep.
And them big leaves.
Do they prepare it the same way as the pitchery?
Yeah.
Same. Oh, yeah.
They get chewed up and put it in ashes.
Yep.
Good.
Mix it into a little ball or something.
Yeah.
How long does it last when it's strong? What sort of effect does it
have? Well, they last for, might be for 2 days.
Oh, yeah.
Sometime they now chew it and suck the juice big out of you.
I read somewhere that people used to put it behind their ear as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Did people put it there
to carry it?
Carry it?
Mm.
Yeah.
They got no tobacco tin, nothing.
Yeah. So you just carry it.
No, Bobby, don't touch it. That man hit you. Naughty.
I read also somewhere that it was sometimes important in sort of ceremonial occasions, that it was passed around.
But that's right.
For people used to sit down and... Yeah.
That's right. They'll cook that pitchery in along, make a big hole, make a big fire, and put it along on the way they dig that hole.
Yeah.
And get a hot ashes and put it over the top of them. And cooked it like that.
Was it only the men that used it?
Man and woman. And cook it in the ashes. Mm. And when you pull them all out, you put it all on the clay pan so the leaves wouldn't fall off, you know. When your leaves fall off, you pick them up and put it in the tin.
So people really stopped using it a long time ago.
Yeah.
And there's just a few people that have kept on.
That's right. All the people from Pandy, they're all died. They wanted a pitchery.
Oh, so they wanted the pitchery down in Pandy?
Yeah.
They carried it in a little, like a wicker bag?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Carried it, and whoever wants it, they'll give them around.
So people went from their own country to Etherbooka country to trade...
Pitchery, yeah. Them day, you know, everybody used to walk for miles.
And how often would they go up to get the pitchery?
Well, when the season's on, you know, good season, rains and everything, water, plenty of water, so they can get water. You can't go without water.
No, we carry plenty of it with them.
Yeah.
So, were there many places in the desert that people could dig down and get water?
Yeah, at my land, out there.
Yeah?
We don't like showing the white fellas.
No, no.
Tourists, anyway.
Yeah. No, we understand that.
Have you been to the springs up north, up in the Mulligan country?
Yeah. A sunny place. They get pitchery.
Right. It only comes from Etherbooka.
Hmm?
It only comes from the Etherbooka.
Yeah, only from Etherbooka.
So were there ever people at Etherbooka who would get the pitchery?
Yeah, and get the pitchery ready for them.
Oh, yeah.
And when they come, then give them to them. Then, in the bag. You know, they put, I don't know what they're crushed in, wool or something.
Oh, okay. And is there anywhere, was there anywhere particular in that, like any particular location or site at Etherbooka where that would happen, where they would meet?
Yeah, that's where they'll meet. They'll make a special place to meet.
Right.
So like a big waterhole.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. They got to go to the, go near the water, and when they get tobacco in station, well, they forget about the pituitary then. They wouldn't worry about it. So once they got a tobacco gun, and they never worry about pituitary then.
Oh, okay. Mm. So people preferred tobacco, really, than pituitary.
That's right.
They preferred to smoke tobacco than...
Ngunku. They call it pituitary. Ngunku.
Ngunku?
Yeah.
What language is that?
Wangkangaroo.
That's really great information for us about pituitary and things.
Pituitary, yeah.
That's
the main tobacco for Aborigine is pituitary.
Yeah.
Then when the tobacco come, well, they didn't bother about pituitary then.
Yeah.
They bought the tobacco then. Governments supplied.
They supplied
tobacco, yeah.
Supplied tobacco.
Right. Yeah.
And that's, did that stop people moving around the country?
That's right.
They they wouldn't move up from Pandy to, up to Etherbooka to get the pituitary?
No. That sort of stops them.
Oh, so they got the, once they got the tobacco, they didn't bother going out there.
That's right.
So that was, the government gave people tobacco for free?
Yeah, free. Rations.
Rations, yeah. Okay, I think that'll be fine.
We appreciate it.
I hope we're not too much of a trouble.
I'll tell you when I'm in tired, you know.
Soon enough.
July 23rd. From sundown until late at night, the camp is alive with the merriment of children, the shrill cries of the women, and the crooning of corroborees by the men. Before dawn, at intervals during the day, and sometimes until an hour late at night, an incessant pounding of nardu goes on, resembling nothing so much as the chipping of a stonecutter's yard.
Late afternoon. Drove 200 kilometres north to Biduri. Population, 120. Local stockman Adrian gave us his take on pituitary.
Yeah, it's still very much in the go for the old fellas anyway.
Yeah? What, young blokes like yourself?
Oh, I've tried it, but made me crook the first time I tried it.
Yeah?
But them old fellas reckon you got to fucking keep going and keep... You know, that's the thing, that's their, when they used to have their fucking reunions or whatever, that was it. They used to have that, and it was their source of marijuana in the old days. Our granddad Will, my girlfriend's grandfather, and he's a man for that, yeah. All the time. He'd rather have that than a smoke. You know, them older fellas do it. Few young fellas have tried it and that, but what gets me is the ash and that. You've got to get the right bark, otherwise it tastes different and not as good or whatever like that. But they leave the ashes settle for a couple of days too. Well, old Grandad Will does anyway.
Yeah, right.
He'll make his fire and burn his bark up and make the ash, and he'll put it in a tin and seal it off, and he'll let it sit for a couple of days, and then he'll roll his tobacco in it. But he used tobacco now because, he used pituitary sometimes when he's out there, but, you know, he's not out there looking for it all the time either.
Yeah.
July 20th. Saddled and started off before daylight, followed the creek, and at 4 miles northwesterly came across a group of natives, two families, who had not had time to escape and made the best of it by a display of friendliness. Led horses down to water to drink. I've called this stream the Mulligan, feeling confident that it will turn out to be an important discovery.
Channels. back on Hopkinson's track, and everything's really green. They've had about 100 mils of rain out here in the last month, and it looks like the green dairy pastures at the south coast. It's amazing.
Day 4. 120 kilometres west of Biduri, we set up camp at sunset on the Mulligan River's Pulchra waterhole on the eastern edge of the Simpson Desert, back on Hodgkinson's path.
Here come the beetles. Okay, Janet's pride. Okay, well, it's pretty much Pulchra waterhole.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually drawn the thing. He's drawn it out very nicely.
Yeah.
He's got pretty close there, hasn't he? His map's not bad.
Yeah. Spot on.
August 7th. Okay. The natives bolted during the night, so I fear the Pichiringa, or Pichiri, will remain unknown. Started out at 9:30, skirting a fine sheet of water which I called Sutherland's Reach. Native fires ahead, so we'll attempt another day's journey. Fortunately, we have sufficient water to give each man a pannikin full tonight and tomorrow morning. July 31st. Camped at Janet's Pride waterhole. At some points, such as this one at Janet's Pride, the Mulligan presents a noble appearance, worthy of being deemed an important river. But at other points, it dies away, and its channel is either a hopeless arid funnel, or else expands into a large flat, where, known only to the natives, precarious supplies of water exist.
While he was at Pulchra, Hodgkinson asked for directions about Pichiri and was told it lay to the northwest. And today we're going to head out to the northwest into the dune fields of the Simpson to have a look for Pichiri.
August 1st. Scanning the horizon, it was evident to me that we were crossing the same country that Captain Sturt had termed the Stony Desert. It looked bleak enough, with undulating stony plains and pebbles of chocolate hue, here and there a bunch of withered wiry grass, and a sombre shrub or two.
We've left Pulchra waterhole, and we were travelling parallel to the sand dunes, in a north-northwest direction, but now we're going straight over the top of them.
Yeah.
We're heading into the country that Sturt described as hell, but sitting in the back seat of a four-wheel drive, looking at all this green grass, looks rather pretty. Upper dune now, probably rising about 7 or 8 metres. And down over the other side.
Of course, as far as the green grass is concerned, you've got to remember that the green grass is spinifex. And this isn't the soft spinifex, this is hard, needle-like spinifex. So walking through this stuff is like walking through little bushes of knitting needles.
Out.
Pichiri, Pichiringa, or Ichirimo are indifferently given as the locations where their narcotic herb is procured.
Day 5. 100 kilometres, or 70 dunes, into the Simpson Desert, approaching Etherbooker Spring. On our way, we met local station owner Dave Smith, who was pumping water for his cattle from one of the Simpsons' many artesian bores.
What do you want to know about that? Not much I know about it.
What was that story you told us before about the old woman?
Clara, yeah, well, she was the last one that I knew that used to use it.
I'd just put it in a bag, break it off the tree and put it in a bag and send it into her, and I don't know what she'd done with it then. I never really took any notice. There's another old fella that was out working on Sandringham when I was a bit younger too. He used to use it, but he's from Bullion. He used to mix it with tobacco and smoke it. Dry it out, he'd dry it out, get the pitchery when it's green, and then dry it out in the fire and mix it up with his tobacco and smoke it like a cigarette. So I don't know what that done for him. In them days, they'd just go and walk about, and they'd just go from the station, and that's where they'd go. They'd go out and collect a lot of pitchery, and 6 weeks later, they'd turn up back again. You know, and that's sort of about all that I've heard about it.
Later that day, as we got closer to Ethelbrooker Spring, we bumped into Dave's neighbour, station owner Howard Duke.
So how long you been out here?
5 years. Yeah. The boys came here first, and well, I've come on and off basis. I've been.
How long on, how long off?
The longest I've been at a stretch would be 5 months.
For people from the cities and stuff that have no idea what this place looks like, would you be able to describe it for us?
Geographically or typically?
Yeah, just how the land looks.
Basically just sand hills with gidgey flats between. Yeah. Is that good enough?
Yeah, it's pretty good. And how about running cattle here? What's it like for running cattle?
Quite all right to run cattle. It's just since we've had, there hasn't been any sort of consistent rainfall. It's been the problem, like over most of Queensland.
Yeah. Hmm. You heard of the pitchery?
Yes, I've seen the pitchery plant. Yeah. And a pretty ordinary plant it is, really, but apparently it must have been okay. The back people used to use it as a drug, and it's nicotine.
Nicotine.
That's what it is. It's the drug in it is nicotine. Mm. So actually all they were doing was having to smoke.
getting there.
Started? Yeah.
Yeah. Unbogged.
Unbogged.
August 6th. Our two native friends manifest a great desire to bolt this morning. And upon my inquiry, it seems that the pitchery is, as it has been for the past week of our journey, just one more night's sleep away from us. There would appear to be two different localities in which the narcotic is obtained, though from Larry's inability to converse with the natives here and their evident reluctance to give reliable information about the pitchery, it's doubtful whether either location will be stumbled upon.
We're at Ethelbrooker Spring right now. This is an old campsite of Aboriginal people around a permanent spring in the eastern edge of the Simpson Desert in the heart of the pitchery country. And just in my hand here, I've just picked up off the ground the remains of bilby and burrowing betong and a hair wallaby. These animals are extinct in the area at the moment. And they've probably been so for the last 50 years. Or more.
Yeah, just near where Mike's kneeling amongst all this bone, there's a fragment of grindstone, and littered around here in very high density are thousands and probably millions of flakes. The remains of people making tools and the actual tools themselves. from people camped here. As Mike's already said, around this, what would have been an extremely important water resource, a permanent Great Artesian Basin spring, right in the middle of the dune fields, the only permanent water around. So it would have been a major focus for people, and an important campsite, and probably one that people would have retreated to in times of long dry, once all the ephemeral waters have really dried up out further out in the dune field.
How long is it since Aboriginal people have been out here?
There's some... I've got an old newspaper record from a journalist who came out here in the late 1880s, and he saw people still burning the country. At that time, he was describing the burning for the purposes of harvesting pitchery, well, for burning off the old plants to get new growth for the next harvest. So there were people still here in the desert then, whether they were permanently occupying it or not, it's not clear. Anthropologist Louise Herkus talks about one of the last groups leaving the Simpson Desert, I think about 1899, and pretty much everybody else by that time was living on stations or an Aboriginal mission to the north of the desert called Yurundanji.
Now, are all of these, the artefacts that are left, are they the materials sourced locally?
Most of the raw material has come from the range country to the north, probably about 60 or 70 kilometres away, and from the Mulligan River to the east of where we are. So everything that's here in terms of the stone tools, stone flakes, and also the grindstones, that's all being carried in over some considerable distance.
What would they have been in trade for, these kind of articles?
Well, the pitchery is known ethnographically to have been a major item that was traded out from this area. So pitchery was probably exchanged for some of these items, like grindstones and spears. And there's one account, someone describing the Aborigines from the area as wanting for nothing because of the trade in pitchery, which was so sought after by other peoples.
Just wandering around the site at Etherbooker Spring. It's interesting that Hodgkinson didn't come here on his travels. It's very close to the Mulligan, very close to where he went. It's possible that the misleading directions given to Hodgkinson by Aborigines about the location of pitchery may have also related to Hodgkinson not finding this spring. It has wonderful, fantastic tasting clear water coming from it. A few years later, when Charles Wernicke passed through here, the spring was considered to have no bottom, meaning that it never dries up. The place was obviously inhabited by a large number of Aboriginal people who would have been burning the land, looking after country, hunting and gathering throughout. Very different to what it's like now as a pastoral grazing property. The other thing, I suppose, that really hits you here is the enormous presence of people at this site. The site is, as I said earlier, covered in cultural artefacts from the Aboriginal occupation, but also with evidence of early European occupation. Just to the north of the spring, there was a fence built around the turn of the century that was intended to slow the entry of rabbits into Queensland, and the fence builders were based here at Etherbooker Spring. And there's a couple of old buildings and yards around, and the grave of the child of the rabbit fence builders. And it says, October 15, 1919, in loving memory, our dear son, John Edward Corkle.
There's a very sobering atmosphere that surrounds this place here at Etherbooker. There's all this evidence of people over long periods of time being here, from all the shell material and bone fragments to the decaying structures that were built by the rabbit fences. I'm just looking to the west of me about 10 metres and there's a bed structure that someone's obviously spent some time building out of gidgeon wire.
an old water drum, and the fact that there's no one here at all now. It's quite eerie. Day 6. Left Ethabooka. Travelled 100 kilometres to Craven's Peak Station on the northern edge of the Simpson. Crossed the Tropic of Capricorn, but still no sight of Pituri. Like Hodgkinson before us, we turned to the locals for some help. Local station cook Jimmy said the Pituri lay 6 or 7 dunes away.
So you go through the rabbit netting fence.
You've got to go through now, through the boundary fence.
Through the boundary.
Yeah, and there's a road going up Barbara Hill, but you've probably seen it now. Yeah. 10 years since I went in there with the dozer and cleaned the springs out. I cleaned the springs out with the big dozer in there.
With the Taco water holes on Craven's Peak?
Yeah, well, you're about 15 miles from there into Taco water hole. 15 might even be more. 18 miles, I'd say.
Mm.
You got 10 caves to Camel Hole. There's a dam here. There's another creek come down there called the Camel Hole Creek. Come down off the ranges up here at the Togo and run back and run into Meetuck when Meetuck comes through the boundary here. Running above it.
We've got to count dunes. How many dunes? 6 or 7 dunes after the gate.
Is pretty close to where Hodgkinson found Pituri while he was travelling between the Mulligan River and the Twin Hills.
Which also makes it quite reasonable to assume that we could actually be finding the very same plants that Hodgkinson found.
Yeah. Only in this part of the world was the plant suitable for drug production. But then within this part of the world, the plant's rare.
So this is it. We're going to find it. Maybe.
Okay, we've just gone over the first dune, so there's 5 or 6 dunes to go. And Hugh and I are holding on in the back seat.
August 17th. Today, most fortunately, while we were crossing the sand ridges, we found the long-looked-for pituri growing. Secured a great bundle of it. The bush is about 4 to 6 feet high, but I must leave its classification to the botanists. Unfortunately, it was not possible to procure a flower or a seed.
This is it.
Long slender leaves with a vein.
Yeah.
Chew it and it's got a bit of a kick. Tastes a bit kind of acrid and bitter at the beginning and then it really
really
has like a tobacco taste if you ever chewed a cigarette.
There's like a clump of 7 shrubs.
Didn't you say they sprout from the roots?
Yeah, they suck her up.
They suck it, so.
And then you can't see another one. That's just like on this one bit of dune. There's all these edible plants around this site with the pituri, a lot more than you'd be used to seeing. We're basically walking around in someone's veggie garden, next to their market garden.
August 28th. Started out at 7:30, camped at 2:40 in the afternoon. Today we discovered a small waterhole, bushed round by the natives for catching birds and rapidly drying up. The blacks, 6 or 7 in number, fled in great fright at our approach, leaving all their worldly wealth, including 2 tomahawks, a boomerang, an aboriginal chisel, some hand nets and an old wallaby skin. I carefully put the nets and weapons in a conspicuous place, so that if the natives returned, they would find them uninjured. Unfortunately, however, we are now approaching the region of dispersions, and the blacks justly dread any white intruder.
Leaving Pitcherie, we decided to make our way to the Toko Gorge country, where I have a strong feeling this is an important part of our Pitcherie Trail. A permanent water supply, so close to the dune fields of the Simpson, an obvious staging point for the trade of Pitcherie. And I think it's a really important point of our journey too. The observations that Hodgkinson made as he moved through this country, and the clearly delineated silent tracks that move along the creeks here. They seem to coalesce and put together a picture of this place.
September 1st, Toko Waterhole. A naturalist, if camped at this particular juncture, might at his leisure procure specimens of all the animal kingdom in the neighbourhood. Thirst conquers fear, and must perforce lead all living creatures to this spot. These two waterholes, which lessen daily, are the resort of every creature for miles round. The timid emu and the plain turkey, the stealthy native dog, all wait patiently for their opportunity. Sometimes a pelican, en passant, loiters to see if a fish may be left. A crane or two, in company with a spoonbill, stand motionless for hours. Four or five shags search every square inch, though the water is so shallow that their efforts to dive beneath are ludicrous. Cockatoos, galahs and their kind scream noisily from the adjoining trees, and countless hosts of finches and parakeets chirp and twitter from dawn to sunset. Night, too, has its activity. Then the lesser marsupials press their well-worn tracks. Nightjars sweep with noiseless wing, and strange cries resound above the ceaseless murmur of the foliage. The very timber bordering the creek reveals the climate here, warped in all fantastic modes, often stunted with scant cover and dense cuticles of bark. It is formed equally to resist the torrents along which it is sometimes swept, or long-continued drought to which it is frequently exposed. Everything here is in extremes, flood or drought, scorching heat or chilling cold. W. O. Hodgkinson, 1876.
Day 7. Today we walked along the Pitcherie Trail. The entrance of a boulder-strewn gorge was our cue to locating Toko Waterhole. Gnarled river red gums fringed the waterhole, their branches laden with flood debris. In the few metres between the waterhole and the steep sides of the gorge lay a path, well trodden by cattle. In 1876, Hodgkinson had skirted the waterhole, following what he'd called a well-beaten native footpath. Searching for a glimpse of the past, we followed the track all day, taking every turn. All I could do was ask, how old was this track? How many people had trod this same path in search of the precious bush? Pausing near a smoke-charred cave, I watched a Euro bolt up the sides of the gorge. Turning back to the track, it was easy to imagine human footprints on the trail ahead, the Pitcherie Trail.
Looking back on the Pitcherie Trail leaves me with mixed feelings. As an archaeologist, I'm most familiar with looking at the past from the perspective of the physical remains, those items that provide a hint or a glimpse of the people that produced them, but never speak directly to you about what they are and what they mean. There is always a perceptible gap between what I want to know and what the past will yield up in response to my questioning. However, whilst on this trip to rediscover the Pitcherie Trail, I was struck, really for the first time, with a scene that made an immediate and clear connection for me from the past to the present. Lying alongside a dry creek bed were three very large blocks of sandstone, each probably weighing between 10 to 20 kilograms, that had been roughly flaked into shape and carried over from the nearby range. These blocks were grindstones, each with either a flat, smooth surface or a circular depression, worn down by thousands of repetitive grinding actions, reducing grass seeds or acacia seeds into an edible watery pulp. Each one of these stones had been carefully stored upside down to prevent the sun damaging their grinding surface. Lying beside them were the top stones, or mullers, that were held in the hand and worked back and forth over the grinding base. These stones had been used, tidied up, and placed into storage, waiting for the next use, waiting for people to return to the gorge once more for another season. But this time, this last time, nobody came back, and the stones remain, waiting patiently in the desert sands.
Day 7. As we break camp here at Toko Gorge, it feels like we're at the crossroads of three different worlds. The world of the Pitchery traders of millennia past, whose camps and tools lie belly up along the trail. The world of the explorers, blazing and claiming a foreign land. And the world of the cattle traders of today. Here, on the northern edge of the Simpson Desert, one of the world's great trade routes once set up market. Like the Silk Road across another arid land, the Pitchery Trail rang with the voices of its traders. It seems easy to imagine Hodgkinson arriving at this spot with his colonial duty and optimism. He had travelled the ancient route, guided by the desert people, following the logic of the landscape's watercourses. Surveying the Pitchery country of the past and imagining the cattle country of today, he stood where we stand now, with this new era, this curious moment in our national history, yet to be negotiated.
You've been listening to Along the Pitchery Trail on Hindsight. Our latter-day expeditioners were Mike Letnick, Tom Murray and Hugh Barton. And if you'd like more information about William Oswald Hodgkinson and his 1876 journey into the Simpson Desert, head to the Hindsight webpage. That's abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Hindsight. And join me, Michelle Rayner, next week on Hindsight and another story of a journey framed by empire and colonialism. This one set on the high seas, as we sail in the wake of the first great Antarctic explorer, Captain James Cook. 2008 is International Polar Year, a year in which thousands of scientists from over 60 nations are carrying out research on the Arctic and Antarctic. But it's not well known that the first major scientific expedition to the Antarctic took place 230 years ago, when the Resolution, commanded by Cook, sailed deep into the Antarctic Ocean. And on board was Georg Forster, a young German writer, barely 20 years old. Forster's account of this voyage is one of the first great travel narratives of the modern era, a vivid description of the terrors and beauty of the Antarctic ice. Published after his return from Cook's expedition, Forster's account became one of the most famous and influential journey narratives of the 18th century. That's Hindsight next week.
listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.